You're listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, activism, and charities. With me, your host, Ethan Clow. And as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming live at citr.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. It has been a while since we've had a new episode of The Sector. Now, that delay is partly due to a couple different things. One, I have been both extraordinarily and incredibly, both of them, very busy the past few weeks with different work projects. And in fact, I mean, I probably shouldn't even be saying this, but I actually am still kind of very busy right now, even as I speak. So I even shouldn't be doing this episode as you're listening to it. But, you know, I realized that I have a responsibility to do this show, not just for you, the adoring public, but for my own sanity. And let's face it, it was starting to go. So here I am doing the show. The other big reason was we've been doing some technical upgrades here at CITR. Now, this, of course, is a bit of a kickback from the move from the old studio to the new studio in the new Student Union building. But I think as of right now, although I could be a bit wrong about this, the brand new podcasting system should be up and live. So that means the new way you download podcasts from CITR will be much improved, hopefully produce a lot better quality podcasts, and ultimately make the browsing experience for you, the listener, a lot more interesting. It should allow for greater customization and hopefully really allow us, the programmers, to tailor our shows and our podcast feeds so that it's easily searchable. You can find whatever episode you're looking for, or let's say an interview, or any kind of content within the episodes that you don't maybe remember which one it was, but you want to hear it again. Hopefully this new system will make it very easy for you to find it. And it's going to be, you know, maybe a couple of weeks before everything gets upgraded and ultimately archives enough so that you can search through it. But I'm actually looking forward to it myself, because again, this should make everything so much more easier and ultimately make it a far more interactive experience. Hopefully, you know, listening to the show and being able to get feedback right away, as well as having that searchability at your fingertips, should be very fantastic. Anyway, I'm very excited about that. Now, but speaking of today's show, we do have a good one today. We're going to talk about a few different topics that have been popping up in the news recently, and things that I've been keeping my eye on from the last little while. Of course, you know, I think a lot of us are still talking about the clock that was a bomb, or turns out wasn't a bomb. You know, I'm sure you've seen the pictures by now, and if you haven't, you can easily find them. But a young boy, created a clock at home, brought it to school, and the teachers thought, oh my God, this is a bomb, and had the boy arrested, which, you know, provoked a fair bit of internet controversy and has generated a fair bit of conversation. So we'll take a look at some of that conversation on the show today. It certainly has provoked some very interesting discussion and worthy of a bit of a second look. Also on today's show, we have a bit of Pope news. It's always exciting when we get some Pope news, so we'll talk about that. And then, actually, I thought it would be kind of fun to maybe do a special encore presentation. You know, we've done a lot of great interviews over the past couple of months, and I was looking over some of them, and I thought, you know, I really wouldn't mind getting some more of this stuff out there again. So we're going to actually do a bit of an encore, play a bit of old interview stuff, and maybe not the whole thing, but just a little bit of it to give you a taste. If you like it, go back and listen to the full episode. But again, it should be just as interesting the first time. In fact, you know, a lot of this stuff is still relevant and kind of a shocking way. But we have a lot to get to, so we'll do all of that. It'll be a great show. Before we do anything else, though, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And we are back here on The Sector. This is episode 53, by the way, here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow. Now, as promised, we were going to dive into kind of a weird topic in a lot of different ways. So you probably heard about Ahmed Mohammed's clock. Now, this young man, a 14-year-old, was arrested after he brought a homemade clock to school. And the school, the teachers, mistook it for a bomb and then had him arrested. Now, as you can probably imagine, this prompted a lot of outrage. People thought this was ludicrous. And to be perfectly blunt, it kind of is ludicrous. It totally is ludicrous. It is something out of a cuckoo's nest. I mean, let's be, no pun intended, of course. But look, the point being is that a lot of people obviously heard about this story and just couldn't believe it. I mean, it touches on a lot of different elements here. Kind of a generally ignorant scientific educational infrastructure, but also race, religion, politics, fear, and the kind of security theater that, you know, we've talked about kind of all of these topics, I guess, on The Sector in the past. So, you know, this was one of those circumstances where we can kind of look back and say all of this stupidity and all of this frustration and fear that has been building up has now perfectly presented itself in a really such a bizarre and almost surreal way. You almost have to kind of pinch yourself to make sure you're not actually asleep. But anyway, getting back to the story, The internet backlash was actually very positive for Ahmed. He got a call out from President Obama, an invitation to the White House. MIT called him out and said, hey, you want to come out and visit our campus, a free tour? So he got a lot of great positive feedback from people who were saying, you know, defending him and praising him for his curiosity and his ingenuity to build the clock. And of course, you know, the sad factor is that there were a lot of people out there who, of course, said, oh, well, you know, the school did the right thing and the police did the right thing, which really, I think, exemplifies the whole question of how, especially in America, race and the potential for violence is so intertwined that the people who have been making these claims are almost entirely blind to what they're actually saying. Those people out there who are saying that, you know, the teachers acted prudently, you really have to ask them, well, if they honestly, really, truly believed that there was a threat there, that clock was in fact a bomb, their reaction does not indicate prudency. Because if you think someone has brought a bomb to school, you don't call the local police. You call the bomb squad or the FBI or a SWAT team. You don't drag the student down to the principal's office and put him in handcuffs. You have armed SWAT team members come in and potentially sniper him, but they drag you out in handcuffs. They don't send you down like you've, you know, been caught passing notes in class. If this was a legitimate bomb scare, if they had really, truly believed that was a bomb, then what the reaction showed us was that they don't take bomb threats seriously, because that's not how you handle a threat like that. And the fact that people are pointing to this and saying that was prudent, well, it seems to really indicate that they have a very twisted definition of what indicates a potential for violence. And that ultimately makes us ask the question is, if this young boy had been white, what would the reaction have been? Now, one of the interesting things, of course, is that we can, if you Google the right terms, I don't really want to get into like what you were going to be searching for to find this kind of stuff, but there are plenty of pictures of young white kids holding rifles, automatic weaponry. And the sort of impunity with which they have these things and are not being tackled by police officers does make you kind of wonder what exactly is going on in the world. How are we living in any kind of post-racial society if this is happening? Now, I'm not really adding a whole lot more of substance to this conversation that hasn't already been said, and I'm not trying to. What I find interesting, though, is some of the backlash was very unexpected. Popular so-called liberal commentator Bill Maher actually went on his show and blasted this young lad, saying that the police, again, acted prudently, that he was a threat, that he's Muslim and therefore is a threat. And of course, you know, none of this is based on any sort of objective reality. We've talked about in the past, not just here on The Sector, but I mean, we talked about this on Radio Free Thinker and elsewhere, racial profiling and the kind of security theater that is being advocated by these so-called smart people does not work. It's been proven not to work. And the fact that they're continuing to rehash this gobbledygook, I think actually really underlines the fact that they themselves have very serious racial blinders on for understanding and even respecting the fact that race is playing a far greater role in this than they are prepared to admit. Of course, not to be left out, the famed biologist, atheist advocate Richard Dawkins, who, again, you know, I've spoken of both positively and negatively in The Sector, as well as Radio Free Thinker, plenty of debates about him, also weighed in on this. And this is, like, again, you know, it really does kind of make you wonder, because Dawkins has really demonstrated a very lack of insight when it comes to expressing his opinions. But this is a good one even for him. So what upset him was not the fact that a 14-year-old who made a clock was arrested for potentially making a bomb. That didn't offend him. He wasn't upset at the police or the educators. He wasn't upset at the system or systemic racism or the anti-science side of this. No. What he was most upset about and most frustrated with was the fact that this young man, Ahmed Mohammed, claimed to have invented a clock. And of course, that's not true because he is not the inventor of clocks. He simply created a clock. He didn't invent it. And of course, for Dawkins, claiming to have invented the clock is just, it's right up there. It's right up there with, you know, denying the Holocaust. It's bad. So, you know, Dawkins took to Twitter to lambast this. And of course, you know, going on further, suggesting that perhaps this young man wanted to be arrested and that he was just trying to get attention because, you know, whatever reason, of course. And this was something that, you know, I think other commentators have pointed to, that this young man, well, you know, he was just trying to start a fire. He was trying to figuratively start a fire. He was trying to get attention for himself. And I mean, he certainly has, but that has much more to do with the fact that a bunch of teachers saw this young man and went, look, a clock that could potentially be a bomb. How dare you express creativity? And again, like, you know, who puts themselves through a media circus like this for the sole purpose of gaining attention? Now, again, there are examples of people who would do something like this, but I seriously really kind of doubt that at the end of the day, what this boy wanted to do was go through The public humiliation of being dragged out of his classroom, put in handcuffs amongst his fellow students for working really hard on something that he was trying to make to impress his instructors, and then become the source of international discussion. I mean, that's not what most people wake up in the morning thinking about. So, and again, this, you know, where I'm going with all this is we all seem to have this notion that smart people, like Richard Dawkins, and, you know, medium intelligent people like Bill Maher, these people claim to be liberals, they claim to be free thinkers, they claim to be up to speed on this concept of social justice, and yet so clearly are on the wrong side of history on this one that it's remarkable that they can't even see that. And it's a good lesson for all of us, I think, to remind ourselves that, you know, we may encounter things that we think are strange or bizarre, or we may not be able to get our heads around, but we should be careful about dismissing things and jumping to sort of snap conclusions, as opposed to kind of thinking something over and going, huh, you know, am I really examining this from very rational corners? Am I giving this the right deal of thought that it deserves? You know, and if your reaction to a social justice claim or an issue that is being brought to the forefront by somebody is to either dismiss it or find some sort of loophole in logic to minimize it, then perhaps you need to do a greater job of thinking about the issue, at least for your own good. If someone is going to say something like Black Lives Matter, and you turn around and say All Lives Matter, then maybe you need to spend a bit more time considering why they're saying that first statement. And I think for someone like Dawkins or Bill Maher, they need to spend a bit more time thinking carefully about what this young man went through. And not so much from the point of view of simply saying, okay, he made a clock and then he got arrested and now he's famous. But to really kind of think about how many times has this young man probably seen his peers get away with something that he just did, bring a small contraption to school. So, you know, that's kind of where I want to go with that and just bring that question up. You know, we really need to be, I think, very careful about how we perceive and try to understand these complex issues, because they're not simple. Social justice is complex. And that's one of the things that, you know, as activists, as people working in the nonprofit sector, we need to be aware of, and we need to train ourselves to have that response to these sort of things. Let's take another quick break here on the show. We'll return with some Pope news here on The Sector.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. This is episode 53 of our great show. So before the break, I was talking a bit about Ahmed Mohammed's clock and giving Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist advocate and all around kind of cranky person, a bit of a tongue wagging, a bit of a thrashing, you might say. And of course he deserved it because, you know, let's be honest, he did. So I'm going to have to re-earn some of that atheist cred by taking on the Pope. And you might say, boy, Ethan, the Pope, I don't know, he's been doing a lot of nice things lately. In fact, I simply heard earlier today that he rejected going to a big fancy dinner in lieu of having a dinner with homeless people. I believe he's in the U.S. right now on some sort of diplomatic tour. So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that he's a bad guy, unlike his predecessor, who was, and I stand by that statement very strongly. But let's talk a bit about something that he did very recently. And I've been critical of well, all popes, actually. But this pope has, in my opinion, done some very interesting things. Well, he himself has certainly stepped away from some of the more hardline conservative elements that we saw in Catholicism. He hasn't exactly abandoned them altogether. And in some ways, he's actually been very sneaky about shifting the attention away from those hardline conservative elements to more sort of, I would say, media-friendly circumstances. You know, things like him washing the feet of a homeless person or preferring to have dinner with homeless people instead of, say, politicians. But recently, Pope Francis gave all of the priests in the Holy See discretion to formally forgive women who have had abortions. Okay, so there's lots of the stuff that we need to unpack in that statement. So first of all, sorry, I'm struggling with my incredulity. I mean, okay, so first of all, the idea that the Roman Catholic Church feels that they are in a position to offer forgiveness in this circumstances is ludicrously insulting. It's ludicrously insulting. And somehow, somewhere, you know, you just have to imagine that there is a room full of old men saying to themselves, I think it's about time that we started to offer our forgiveness to women who we have systemically repressed, demonized, and in some cases pushed legislation upon that may have killed them. And the idea that they're going to sit back and be like, you know what, we forgive you for your sins. It really does make you kind of scratch your head and just go, wow, they certainly have their priorities so far removed from today's ethical quandaries that it is actually kind of amazing. So let's further unpack this. Now, we're going to take it as a point of no contention that a woman has the right to decide what happens to her body, including what's inside her body. I think that's a pretty important right for women to have. Now, the idea that the church, which has obviously historically opposed abortion, and to be perfectly honest, and if we're going to be frank, has opposed the notion of not just bodily autonomy for women, but autonomy for women, period, then the idea that they are going to extend forgiveness is not simply an insult, it's an attack on the idea that women have a right, a legal, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, that they actually even have a concept of autonomy, that you would offer forgiveness to somebody who is not seeking it reduces their agency. It's demeaning in so many different ways. And by doing this sort of thing, they are putting out the notion that, look, we as the Catholic Church, we view you as intellectually, spiritually, and civically inferior, and we forgive you for it. It's so far removed from this notion of, you know, the cool Pope who is going around helping people, that this is how they are going to structure their conversation on abortion. And I think what's telling about this is that if you look at the press releases regarding this announcement, there's a quote here from Vatican Chief Spokesman Father Federico Lombardi, who said, quote, "This is by no means an attempt to minimize the gravity of this sin, but to widen the possibility of showing mercy." And again, I mean, what we're talking about here is not any kind of progress towards the Catholic Church recognizing autonomy of women. This is going backwards, because they are now reframing this not as a choice made by a free human being, not by the free expression of somebody who is, you know, born free or has earned freedom, but they are describing this as sin. So, right out of the bat, women who have abortions are weak, morally inferior, and require mercy from an institution of men to gain absolution. Yeah, I mean, you just kind of think about it and it makes you sick, doesn't it? What's also, I mean, remarkable in so many ways is the fact that there's this blindness within the church, coming from Pope Francis himself. He described in a letter the, quote, existential and moral ordeal the women who have terminated pregnancies faced, and that he, quote, met so many women who bear in their heart the scar of this agonizing and painful decision. Which, again, where is that sympathy? Where is that concern for women who have been raped or abused or faced sexual violence that led them to this decision? And again, that's only one small subsection of women who decide to get abortions. But the fact that they are offering sympathy, not for the women who find themselves in conditions where they have to consider an abortion, but that they are offering sympathy to women who have already made that decision and who are dealing with the guilt, which is fostered in of itself by the Catholic Church. So they are feeling guilt because of the guilt trip that the Catholic Church is dragging them through, and then they're going to turn around and be, oh, I really pity you for the way that we're treating you. Oh, sorry about that, kind of. Not really, but sorry. Of course, what adds some salt to the wound is that this is not going to be a permanent thing. This is only for the holidays. So, Merry Christmas. Yay. You know, and I think to not make light of this, but the fact is that this is so draconianly terrible, and that instead of displaying this kind of cool Pope image in the media, there really needs to be more attention paid to what this is actually saying and what this means for the women who find themselves, you know, in a predominantly Catholic society where they have to deal with this. I mean, this is not simply something you can just, you know, let roll off your back. You actually have to grow up with this. You have to internalize this sort of thing, and it affects you psychologically. It's going to affect how you interact with other human beings. And that is not something that you can just whitewash away. It's going to have a huge impact on somebody. And to grow up in that kind of environment where you are dealing with that sort of pressure, you know, that there's no way to describe what that must be like for somebody who has to then make difficult decisions about what happens to them, not just for their health, but for their well-being, for their future. You know, having children is not something that you just do because you're bored. You need to have a plan in place, not just for the sake of the children themselves, but for your own sanity and well-being. And again, not to belabor the point, but the historical blindness here that we're talking about is not just limited to the far distant past. The Catholic Church is doing a lot present day stuff, and developed countries like the Philippines and Africa and elsewhere, limiting sex ed treatment, limiting access to birth control, limiting access to the kind of free and important health solutions that we take for granted here in the West, they are creating their own circumstances for which women are forced to make decisions like this. So the idea that they're now going to say, we're going to offer limited time forgiveness for a circumstance that they are helping to create is, you know, it's a special kind of evil. And again, as proponents of social justice, we cannot let this sort of thing go idly by and not call it out when we see it. And we can't get caught up in this whole cool Pope persona any longer. It's simply, you cannot do so with a straight face anymore and call yourself an activist if you let something like this slide. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. Now, before the break, I mentioned that we were going to have a special encore presentation of one of our classic interviews. This one comes back from episode 21, where we talked with the HAVE Culinary Society. We had an interview with Glenn Lamont talking about HAVE, which was a social enterprise operating in the downtown east side of Vancouver. So we're going to air a bit more of that interview. And if you like it and want to get the full version, check out episode 21. It's available in our show notes over at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, let's turn it over to this special encore presentation. Stay tuned. Joining us now on The Sector is Glenn Lamont. Glenn is a student counselor and job developer with HAVE, Culinary Training Society. Glenn, welcome to the show, and thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Ethan, on this lovely Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. So, Glenn, we've discussed on The Sector previously that there are more ways to do good in the community beyond charities or nonprofits. So why don't we start off by talking about what HAVE does for the community?
Well, HAVE is a training program and job placement program. So we're a nonprofit, but we're also a social enterprise. We do culinary training for people with barriers to employment. And then at the end of our 8-week program, we do our best to place them in suitable positions in kitchens throughout the city, sometimes throughout the province. We really very much take a hands-on approach to things. We like to think that we offer a solution and a way for people to make a decision and put it into action. You know, we're just there to facilitate. But we chose a sector of the industry that's very sustainable. There are always jobs out there. So we never have a problem filling positions. But mostly what we do is, you know, give people a hand up instead of a handout.
And how did you get involved with HAVE, and what do you do there?
Well, my job is a student counselor. So we are as I said, we work with people with barriers to employment. So, and a barrier, I mean, that's a hugely broad term, right? I think because we're in the downtown East Side, people automatically assume, you know, mental health and addiction is the only things that we deal with. And we do deal with that, but we deal with so much more. We deal with English as a second language. Age can be a barrier. We deal with people with learning disabilities. Anything that is going to stop you from competing on a level playing field with the rest of society when it comes to employment, when it comes to accessing services, any of those things, that's what we consider to be a barrier. So my job is to supplement the culinary training with life skills training, with one-on-one counseling if need be, communication skills, visualization, goal setting, all those kind of things, money management, anything that I can think of that is going to help somebody to seamlessly make that transition back into the workforce or maybe into the workforce for the very first time. And then I also do the job development, which kind of fell into my lap. That's not what my position started out to be. But I started with HAVE originally in 2009, and I actually went through the HAVE program myself. I had just come back. I was over in the UK for 10 years, and I'd come back to Canada and was kind of just kicking around. And so I went through the program, and Amber actually offered me, Amber Anderson, our executive director, offered me a job as an instructor to stay on. And in that time that I was with them as an instructor, you know, I spent more time dealing with personal issues with the students than I did actually teaching cooking. And well, plus I'm not a very good cook either, so that kind of had something to do with it. So we'd agreed. We'd always said, her and I, that whenever there was funding available for the position of counselor, that that she would offer that to me right away. So I left on medical leave. I went and had an operation. I worked on another project in the downtown East Side, a community development project. I went back to school for counseling psychology. And then and when some money came back, came through for funding, they gave me a call. And so we always knew that position was really essential, but there was just never any money for it. But we're doing okay now, so, you know, it's worked out really well, and HAVE just seems to be, you know, I'm very, very much connected to the program, having been through it, but I'm also very connected to it because my background is the same, essentially, as many, many of the students that come through. I struggled with my own addiction for 25 years, and I'm a pretty smart guy, I like to think, anyways. But regardless, you know, that addiction took my career. It took me to all the places that I never thought I would be, including homeless, on the street, in jail, in hospitals, you know, till I was finally at my very, very, very bottom. And that's when I got sober. So when a person comes through our door and that's their background, you know, right away we have a lot of common ground there. And it's also nice to be able to say that to a student, to a potential, you know, success story, to be able to say, you know, dude, 8.5 years ago I was you, mm-hmm. but I am now doing what I love and getting paid to do it. So that is, in a long-winded way, how I got involved with that.
Well, excellent. And
So for listeners who may not be familiar with the Downtown East Side in Vancouver, it's one of the city's poorest neighborhoods. It's one of the poorest in the countries, but there's a very strong sense of community activism. So Glenn, what would you say is the Downtown East Side's defining characteristics?
Well, some words I might use to describe the Downtown East Side. You know, number one that most people don't think about that comes to mind for me is community. There's a very, very strong sense of community there. This is people's backyards. This is people's neighborhoods. People forget that a lot of families live in the Downtown East Side. Mostly the press, you know, anytime they do a story, we're misrepresented as just this, you know, this ghetto, and it's all about the addiction issues and the street drugs and the poverty and lack of housing and all these things. All these things are an issue, absolutely, but you will never meet a sector of this city that has a stronger sense of community than the Downtown East Side. You know, it's the oldest neighborhood in the city. It's the last affordable place to live. And it can be, you know, there are days when I look at that city and, you know, that part of the city, the Downtown East Side, and there are days when I just see all the misery and the pain. And at the same time, I have met some of the most talented, some of the smartest, some of the most amazing, wonderful people that I've ever had the pleasure to meet, and I've traveled a lot, you know. They're all right there in that small area. You know, and there's so many, you know, small businesses that have been there for decades. And so, you know, the Downtown East Side is many, many things. Yes, it is, you know, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the nation. Yet at the same time, you know, it has a real sense of strength with the people who live there. It has a real, you know, authenticity to it that you're not going to find in any other part of the city. Put it this way, I don't think you're going to be seeing a Starbucks anytime soon.
Well, that actually kind of leads me to my next question. There's been a lot of new development, new businesses, new people moving into the Downtown East Side, and it's raised a lot of discussion and debate about the community. What is your sense on this new development in the Downtown East Side, and how is it affecting, you know, doing good in the Downtown East Side?
Well, geez, that's a lot of questions all in one, really. So, first of all, the gentrification thing, you know, it's happening. I don't see really a way around it. And when I say that, I'm not on either side of the fence. I'm an observer on this one. I see it happening. And you know, the bottom line is, for many, 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 many years, it was convenient for the Downtown East Side to be a ghetto. It was convenient for the, you know, for all parties involved. We will put all the services down there. We know where all those people are at all times. So, you know, good middle-class citizens know not to go there, unless, of course, you know, it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning and they're trying to score drugs. So it's always been convenient, right? But then what happened was, with the way real estate has gone in Vancouver, there's no place left to go. You know, million-dollar homes are a normal thing here now. And so it's the last place for developers to go as well. And when developers who have money want in, you know, there's really no stopping them. So to be able to find a balance is going to be the greatest challenge. And when I say balance, I really mean a balance. I don't mean, you know, allowing these new developments to come in and just take over. I mean, there needs to be people who, you know, are going to be living side by side, and they're going to need to find a way to do that, because, as I said, it's the last affordable place in the city. There's a huge number of seniors in the downtown east side. There are families down there, and there's nothing you can do about that. So that needs to be taken in consideration. So, you know, really the city, the provincial government, and specifically the federal government really needs to step up to the plate on the housing issue. So as far as how our little enterprise fits into that, you know, we don't have much to do with the politics down there. We have a program that is free. And because we're a program for people with barriers, we don't have any barriers to get into the program. We're an ongoing intake. A student comes in, a potential student comes in. We chat for 5 or 10 minutes. We get them to fill out the paperwork, and then we say, okay, you start Monday. And they're always amazed by that. They're like, you mean this Monday? 'Cause they're used to being told you're on a waiting list. They're right. Used to being told we'll call you, or we just got to process your forms, and you lose people in that time. When an individual makes a decision to do something with their life, you have a very, very short window of opportunity to help them. Because they've had doors slammed in their faces all their lives. They've been told nothing but no, and you're not good enough, and you're pretty useless, so why bother? So if they do happen to wander through our door, and we caught them on that day that they decided, I'm going to make a big change, we want to facilitate that as soon as possible. And what we do, we know works. We're not huge, so we're not this big factory turning out, potential Gordon Ramsays of the future on a weekly basis. We do what we can with what we have. But having said that, you know, in the last 7 years, since 2007, we have trained and found employment for a little over 600 individuals, most of whom were previously on income assistance. So we don't see ourselves going anywhere, gentrification or no gentrification, because that is, that's our home. People know us. We get lots of people coming by on a regular basis. We have our regular clientele who eats there, people from the courthouse, people from some of the nonprofits who work down there. We get a lot of people who come in that, they could eat elsewhere, because there are some pretty nice places to eat, like Railtown Cafe and places like that, but they choose to come and support what we do at HAP.
Well, I've seen your reviews on Yelp and the Urban Spoon, so they're very good.
Well, for the most part, we don't get too many people complaining. The students, they're well supervised, but everything that is on that menu is prepared by the students. When we have a really busy day, they're in there, giving it all they've got, and they're very nervous, they want to get the food out on time. They want it to be the best possible quality. And it's one of the reasons our program works, because we have that restaurant and because we have catering contracts. It's totally hands-on for the student from day one. On their very first day, they're right into the kitchen. And it's the best way to learn. you know, for the students, it's an 8-week program. For them, they're like, oh my God, 8 weeks. And for us, we're like, oh my God, 8 weeks. Because for us, it's not a long time to take a person, evaluate them, evaluate their barriers, train them, and try and remove as many barriers as possible, and send them back out into the world. But it's an amazing array of individuals that come to our program. Amazing, you know, especially when we get, I love it when we get success stories. And our success stories are usually the people that, when they're walking through those doors, you know, you can't help it, but you interview them and then they leave and you think, oh my God, not a hope in hell does this person have. And they're always the ones that surprise you. And we love it when somebody gets a job and, you know, they come back to us in 6 months to say, you know, I moved. I've got an apartment. You know, I got a salary increase. You know, they're bumping me up to a better position. You know, so as it's a lot of hard work for everyone, mostly the students, and we have a lot of frustration, and you know, there's just a lot of passion and effort goes into what we do. But when we have our successes, it makes it all worthwhile.
Well, we will fade it out there. And again, if you want to catch the full interview with Glenn, you can check out episode 21 of The Sector. That was just a great little bit of that interview. One of my favorites from The Sector here. Well, we're out of time on this show, so we'll be wrapping things up. This has been Ethan Clow, your host. Hoping you enjoyed another episode of The Sector. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can find our podcast, our show notes, links to anything that we talked about on the show over at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. We're also on Twitter at sectorpodcast and at Ethan Clow. That's me, obviously. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And if you have any thoughts or questions or concerns about anything that you've heard here on The Sector, feel free to email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Love to hear your feedback. If you have any ideas for show topics or interviews, please, please get in touch. Well, until next week, this is Ethan Clow, your host, saying good night. Thank you for listening. We will see you all next time.